Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
Chris Casso.
Hello.
And, of course, Mr. Cole Hornaday.
Hey there.
And today we have a special guest with us, writer of the Bronte's Infernal Angry and Some Strange Disturbances. Please welcome Craig Hurd McKenney.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us, Craig.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Well, to tell us more about you, I'm going to throw it over to Mr. Chris Casso.
Hello. So, just to start off, so you've written for Fantagraphics and MTV, and you're also a Zarek Award winner. Award winner. You won the grant for the Brontes, the first issue of the Brontes, back in 2004. For those not familiar with the Zarek, it was a charitable foundation that would reward creators just trying to get new talents out there, just to help them produce material. And I believe it was founded by Peter Laird? I think so?
It was one of the two of them.
Yeah, one of the Kevin Eastman.
I'm pretty sure it's Laird. Kevin Eastman.
Yeah.
Is it Kevin Eastman? Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, sorry about that.
Peter, if you're listening,
I'm sure he's going to be crying all the way to the bank.
I'm going to double check that later. Yeah. So you're also an Ignatz Award nominated writer. You were nominated under the category of Outstanding Debut for Stalagmite 2 in 2004 as well. And then in 2000, you started Headless Shakespeare Press, and as an outlet for your zines, mini-comics, anthologies, graphic novels. And now it is a hub for queer comics with an eye towards representation, inclusion in content, and in creator credits so that new voices can be raised up. And we are all about that here.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Yay.
Just to name a few of your titles, you've written The Magic If. We already mentioned The Brontes, Infernal Angria, which you did with Rick Geary, Walt Whitman's War, and Some Strange Disturbances, which you published in 2018 as a Kickstarter. So if you don't mind, let's talk about Some Strange Disturbances a bit, just to start off. So that was 2018 project, was successful. We have copies in the store right now. And it's a Victorian-era horror story featuring a diverse LGBTQ cast. And it deals with racism, the differences between classes, queerphobia, and more. I absolutely loved it.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And I gave it to Cole, and I'm just like, this is your peanut butter and your jam.
Well, and I tell the honest truth is, Chris sent us a PDF earlier this week, and I didn't get around to looking at it until actually this afternoon. And I got about 9 pages into it. I'm like, oh, stop. This is extraordinary. And I want to have the actual book in my hand because I'm flipping through it, and I'm like, this person has done his homework on the Victorian period and the spiritualist movement. And oh my goodness, there's graphics and pages from the London Police News. There we go. Once in a while I mentioned that I've been a reader of the Fortean Times for like over 30 years. Well, they put excerpts just like this in the back of the Fortean Times. And I'm like, this is marvelous. And and Oscar Wilde. You know, so
really, you're just here so we can gush over your work.
Hey, I'll take it.
There are worse things to do on a Thursday night.
I have not read the whole book yet, but I'm already sold on its brilliance, and I think it's also going to be one of those books I'm going to need to savor, because you said you've got other follow-up stories in the works?
Correct. We just successfully kickstarted the second volume at the end of September.
Nice.
And so that'll be coming out by the end of April of next year.
Nice.
Cool.
Yes.
Did you have another question?
You go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, well, I wanted to talk with you a little bit about the research that you put into this.
Because
your final takeaway of your research of the spiritualist movement, because it's so interesting and so bizarre, and we've all kind of forgotten about what the previous millennium did to the psyche of the Western Hemisphere, and one of the bizarro things that came out of it was the spiritualist movement. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, with the Fox sisters and the seances and all these thousands of people who started a whole movement around shysters and theater performers, essentially. Mm-hmm. These little girls would crack their toe knuckles and rap on wood and convince people that they were communicating with the great beyond. And then ultimately you get Madame Blavatsky, and then you get... I did a lot. I was going to write a play about this.
You're doing great. I can just sit here. But
ultimately, let's talk about your influences. Yes,
exactly. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about
your influences.
About me, and I'm really good at that. I'm terribly sorry.
I'm glad that you brought up that. There's so many different layers to it. I think the pieces that I was drawn to, and we'll get to some of them, and mm-hmm. we won't get to some of them.
Okay.
But I think there is a difference between American and English spiritualism.
Totally.
So there will be a little bit of that. The character, one of the main characters, he's living in England, but he's American. Mm-hmm. So what we see is the British version of that.
Gotcha.
So eventually there will be some of that. I think the other piece that was really fascinating to me is that the spiritualists had sort of turf war with the Darwinists. The Darwinists were arguing that, well, if ghosts are real, wouldn't we have ghosts of like animals talking to us too? So
right.
why don't we have that?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that comes up in future stories.
Excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm a deep dive researcher. I can get stuck doing that for days, but
yes.
I have to like eventually pull myself out of it.
Come back to the present.
I'm sure there's more that I could have done.
Well, here, answer me this. Do you deal with the Cottingley fairies at any point?
That is book 4.
There you go.
Love you so much.
It's all planned out.
I am so into you right now. You don't even know.
So one of the things I loved about this book is that you have about 5 pages in the back where you talk about some of the research and some of the social settings, and you give links and connections to it all. And I think you should also probably print an annotated book to go, of that material.
Ooh, yeah.
Once you get 3 or 4 of the graphic novels done, here's all my research, you know?
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Because, there's elements here that were fresh to me because I'm not that well read up on any of this material, and it was utterly fascinating to read.
You.
So like I joke that sometimes I love the back material more than the front book. I loved everything in this, so good balance.
Yeah. So the afterword material was information that I thought was really important for the Kickstarter backers to know, so that they would kind of have a little bit of a preview of what they were getting. In the lead up to getting the book, and I asked their permission, like, are you all okay if I actually print this in the book? Because I think it will be useful to everyone else as well. And no one complained and said, no, that's special material for us.
Yeah.
So I hope that people have the reaction that you do, where they really see that it is a fully realized world. It's not just made up, and that we actually are situated in real things that are happening. And I think that's another reason why having the Oscar Wilde trial going on during that period of the setting of the first book is really important, to highlight some of those non-horror horrors that people are dealing with.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And like you said about the world building, one of the aspects I love is the world building is in the characters too, and the community you start to build here. And your future books are starring some of the same characters, but it sounds like when I was double checking your Kickstarter, but you're going to introduce new characters along the way.
There will be new characters in the second volume, yes.
Yeah, I absolutely love the range of characters you have in here.
The trio will still be there, though. They're
perfect.
They are the heart of the book.
Yes. Yeah, I absolutely love them. Just some background for the listeners. So the main character is the spiritualist. He's a gay man, and he's dealing with hiding, kind of. And one of the other characters you're introduced to is the doctor, or the son of a lord who is trans, but they lock them up into a insane asylum.
Spoiler alert.
Sorry. Sorry. I loved it so much. I don't care.
It's okay.
And so you introduce that character, and then there's why am I blacking out on her name?
Delilah.
Delilah's absolutely fantastic. Yeah, she's the choral singer. And
Delilah was not in the original story.
Yes.
I had taken some time off from writing comics, and one of my colleagues, I am a former professor of English, and she is a poet, and she was like, I'm working on stuff. You should be working on stuff too. Like, why don't you do graphic novels anymore? Like, you had all this back stuff. And I was like, well, you know, and then finally I started taking her advice, and I was like, okay, I have a script for you. Why don't you read it? And she read it, and she said, oh, this is fascinating. Like, England is very white in this story. Mm-hmm. And it was like a gut punch because I, you know, I'm an equity and inclusion advocate. And it was having her say that, mm-hmm. that I was like, oh, crap. Yeah. Like, I really have dropped the ball here. And so another of the areas of research that I did to try to balance that was to look at the exorbitant amount of photographs from that period, mm-hmm. that are of African-American women, and a lot of them were choral performers, traveling choral performers. And I just was like, that's it. That's it. That's how she fits in. She can navigate those social, the social race and class stuff because she is of a certain, race in Victorian England is very complicated, but you can, your sort of TLDR is that if you were of a certain social class, this color of your skin didn't matter. Mm-hmm. So she's in these places where she wouldn't be if she was in America. And so that is one of the pieces of passing or horror for her, is that she realizes she has a privilege that her family back home wouldn't have.
Was that because she was an entertainer, and as an entertainer, you are sort of like an outside, a welcome outsider?
Right.
And so color is, they're kind of got blind to
color.
And
the same thing, to go back to your question about like the charlatans and the spiritualist movement.
Right.
That's how Prescott, the gay psychic, can get into these zones too, because people are really wanting to buy into that and I mean, he's a real psychic, and real psychic in quotation marks, but so yeah, they're both in the similar boat of not really fitting in, but they're able to pass.
Marvelous. Can we talk a little bit about the Brontes?
Yeah.
Because I have not read this book, but flipping through it, I had a response that has some, it's not an uncommon response, and I would like Craig to share some background on this, but I flipped it up and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's Rick Geary. And I haven't seen this much Rick Geary work since the mid 80s or the early 90s. And it's really beautiful. And that's quite a boon for a writer to land an artist like this. Can you tell us about getting him involved with your book?
Sure. So I am like an old school Rick Geary fan.
Yeah.
I read all of those early black and white Dark Horse books. I miss the National Lampoon stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's recreated and reinvented himself generationally, and it's fantastic to watch his books. That really sort of drew me to sending the invitation to him to do the book were the Victorian murder books that MBM puts out. And now he's doing 20th Century Murder as well. So he's very prolific. And the benefit of having Rick on board was that I didn't have to do a lot of like prepping him for drawing it, because he just knew what to do.
He knows the era well.
Yeah. The only thing that I sent him were photos from the actual house that the Brontes lived in, because I had visited there twice and just took a ton of photos.
Really?
So there's a little bit of photo reference that he used for inside the house, but everything else is just from his own vision, and it's amazing. So my note to people at home is, don't hesitate to send emails to people that you like, because the worst that they'll say is no. And I got lucky, and Rick said yes.
Well, we've learned that talking to a couple of writers on our podcast. There was the fellow that reached out to the original author of who censored Roger Rabbit.
Remember? Yes, Alex Van Keen.
Yeah. And that's when, because, you know, as a younger person, I reached out to folks all the time and got no's, and was like, well, it's because and I came up with terrible stories. I told myself about why I was unworthy. But yeah, Alex has reached out to, is that his name?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. and now is working on a comic book sequel to Who Framed Roger Rabbit, or Who Censored Roger Rabbit.
Right.
It takes a bit of chutzpah, you know. It takes a little. I mean, you got to admit, it takes a little bit of hubris to.
to do that. Yes,
especially if it's someone you love and respect.
Yes, and I think I fully empathize with the idea that you would make up a story if they said no, because you could take it personally. I think the me of 20 years ago, when I very first started, I probably would have taken that very personally. And so it was good that I took some time off, and I went back to school and got my PhD. So there's a bit of a gap in the Headless Shakespeare Press time frame. But now that I'm back, it's just part of the gig, right?
Yeah.
Like people say no, it's not
not the end of the
world. You can't take it personally. And same thing with reviews that you might not love everything they say.
Sure.
As long as you're not mean, I can take the criticism. I don't like mean reviews. But it does take, I think, to do this work, it does take a thick skin and a little bit of hubris to be able to reach out to people and invite them to play with you.
Mm-hmm. You kind of touched on something that we talked about before we got in front of the microphone, which is your writing process and who you invite for constructive feedback. Mm-hmm. And you said you had...
I have beta readers.
You have beta readers. And I looked at you like, are you joking?
No, I'm not. Okay. I'm not. So I would say I have two groups. I have beta readers mm-hmm. who are friends that I know will give like very harsh criticism if it's necessary.
Right.
And they know that that's not going to destroy our friendship.
Okay.
That they can give me that feedback, and that's why I'm asking them to read it.
Also takes a special kind of person to accept that feedback.
Yes. And I would not have been able to have handled it 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Now I just know that that's part of the gig. And
right.
So it's fantastic. People have caught... plot holes and where did this thing go? I won't tell you what it is because it's coming up in the next mm-hmm. And I sometimes catch them too, but mm-hmm. it just raises your awareness of what you're doing, right? You can love it to the point where you won't make changes, but I don't think that makes the best book. And having given over some of that control for some strange disturbances, mm-hmm. I really feel like this is probably the best work that I have done. Not to say that the Bronte's Infernal Angria is not good and The Magic If is not good, because I love them too, but mm-hmm. I really feel like Some Strange Disturbances is just a new renaissance for the type of work that I'm doing. So the beta readers, friends that read and give me strict, harsh criticism that I need and want. And then I also have sensitivity readers, and I know there's a whole thing around that too, but it, you know, when you're writing a character like Delilah, mm-hmm. who's an African-American woman, I'm not an African-American woman, so mm-hmm. I can't write that truth 100%. Mm-hmm. So I want to make sure, am I presenting this mm-hmm. right. in a respectful,
you still
want to
get the story out there.
Yeah. So,
but yeah.
And
yeah.
the same with the comtesse as well. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not a trans person, and I had a lot of involvement in the solicitation material that went out. Am I phrasing this okay? And you know, it's veiled because that is part of the mm-hmm. reveal of the story.
Sorry.
Is that the character is trans. No, it's fine.
Yeah.
And I'm actually appreciative of that because it actually helps. It's hard to sell the book to trans people when you can't tell them
that that's the element. Yes. I'll ruin everything for you in the future then. where I'm a Viking.
And I'm very fortunate because as someone who has trans people in my life, I wanted to tell that story as authentically as possible, but it's not entirely my story to tell. So just to make sure that I'm being held accountable in mm-hmm. the same way that I was held accountable that there was no racial diversity in the first go round of Some Strange Disturbances.
Gotcha.
And to me, if my goal is to be as equitable and diverse and to raise those other voices up, I've got to invite them to the party mm-hmm. or I'm mm-hmm. just blowing my own whistle.
That's right.
Sounds like you know how to do your homework, and that's not surprising seeing as how you're a former English professor and you also wrote a book about the Brontes. Yeah. What got you writing comics in the first place?
I will say I've always loved comics. When I was a kid, we were on a farm that was way outside of Dallas, Texas. So my mom would drive us into the city, I would say once a month, to the library to get books. And that was sort of the getaway from being so far away from everything, really. And so storytelling is something that's always stuck with me. I remember my parents talking about times where there would be a commercial on TV and I would completely like re-edit it and tell them this would be a way better way to do that commercial. And they'd be like, oh my God, he's right. So finding ways to tell stories, I think, is just something that's always been intrinsic to the way that I look at the world. Mm-hmm. And then it wasn't until probably I was in high school that I started like doing little doodles and building out stories. And it's not like the zines or the mini comics of today, which is like the intent is to be read. It was more so for me and
just to get it out.
Yeah, just to get it out. Yeah. And then like one of my friends who I still am friends with today, she saw that I was doing it and she was like, oh, can I see that? And so then I started, then I had an audience of one. And so then I started making them a little bit more formal. And so it's just, it's been like that ever since.
Cool. So yeah. I know you're just saying formal. I absolutely love your production values.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Yes. That means a lot because it is something that I have always had as one of my mantras. So it is always incredibly meaningful when people mention that, not just because it makes me feel good, but that it's acknowledged that it is like I'm trying to have that be part of the Headless Shakespeare brand.
Yeah, no, format's a big part of my OCD. Thanks.
Me too.
And so sometimes, did you notice how many times he restacked his little stack of books here?
But I didn't realize I do that.
Sorry, buddy.
We get a lot of local creators that bring stuff in. We get, you know, a huge range of format, style, and everything. And we do like to support everybody, but sometimes somebody brings something like this in, and it's just like, oh, yes, please. So well done. I just did it again.
Okay, now maybe I'll stop now. Just about it. I'm sorry.
You're not going to stop. But,
And can I just add one little bit to this? When I was starting back, we had the original issue of the Bronte, so it was just the 24 pages we'd done, and then the original Magic F, which was in floppy form. And I believe that you were one of the people that told me, you know, the one thing that you could do that would just step this up to have it have lasting shelf power would be if it was a little heavier quality.
Right.
And I have to tell you, I've carried that with me since then, because you're absolutely right. If it's floppy, it's not going to last. I've actually seen, my brother brought out his copies of the original run of things, and they just look, they look ragged. And so
they get crushed and,
Yeah,
this way they just have that lasting shelf life and just a little bit extra draw, you know, on a retail level. That is, can make or break things. So on the next book you've got, it's called The Lunchroom Under the Arch.
Yes.
Can you tell us anything about that?
Yes. Yeah. It picks up very shortly after the end of part one. And you get a little bit of a tease at the end when he sees the advertisement in the newspaper for help researching this or investigating a ghost that appears in a lunchroom down at the wharfs. And so that's a part of it. And
you don't have to spoil anything.
You're talking about book two of Some Strange Disturbances.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I will say that Prescott's about to take a turn back into, he's struggling with opium use to try to silence the ghosts. I have tinnitus. And so for me, sorting through levels of sound is something that I wanted to capture in him. And so for people who don't know about tinnitus, it's a real struggle because you hear ringing constantly and it will vary at its pitch. So sometimes you can hear certain people talking and you can't hear other people talking, or you can't hear sounds like cars coming by as you're trying to cross the street. And I am not an opium addict, but I wanted to capture, like, how does somebody in that period try to control the levels of noise that he's getting from all the ghosts that are talking to him. And so he descends into opium use. Let's see, what else can I,
now I want to talk about our shared tinnitus.
That's
for the tinnitus podcast.
That'll be tinnitus today podcast.
The Comtess is opening the shop and she will have a journey that will be somewhat dark, which all their journeys are dark, but hers is particularly dark, and you'll know what I mean when you read it.
Okay.
And Delilah gets a bit of news that she was not expecting.
Okay.
Mystery. Intrigue.
I did want to ask you about your experiences with Kickstarter versus other self-publishing beforehand. You know, like, are there elements of it that you appreciate more or less? Was it particularly difficult at first, or do you have that stress of, like, is it gonna go through, you know, at a certain point in time, you know?
All of the above. The first one that I did was for the Brontes. It was not successful. I was just an idiot in terms of what Kickstarter was and how to work it. fortunately, the relationships that I had built when I very first started doing comics, a lot of those people had done successful Kickstarter. So I was able to sort of pick their brains and talk with them about, well, what did you do? How did you do it? It is literally a full-time job. So I I don't take those on lightly because you have to be pushing content every single day. It's exhausting. Mm-hmm. And then weeks 2 and 3 of the campaign will make you reconsider all of your life choices. You want to talk about like being ripped down to your core. Weeks 2 and 3 of a Kickstarter will literally do it to you.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's a lot of stress. And then you just pray that week 4 will be the upswing, which usually it is.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's not for the faint of heart. So I would highly recommend that for new people who are starting, don't do it that way because it could potentially dissuade people from continuing to do it. Yeah, break you because it, well, we secretly all have the inner voice that tells us we're not good enough. Mm-hmm. Like that's just not a mystery about humanity.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Some of us can turn it off and tap into that hubris. Yeah. And then some of us, it will just destroy us. So, just to be fair, like it's not for everybody to do. Mm-hmm. I have a concern around the during the last project, for book 2 of Some Strange Disturbances, they started union busting at Kickstarter. So I have like business side concerns in that way. Mm. They fired the people who were trying to organize the union.
Really?
Yeah. And so that makes me second guess that platform. So I'm interested to see how that discussion goes. And if it goes the way that I hope that it doesn't, I'll look at other platforms, which I know a lot of people have used Patreon. Uh-huh. A lot of people have used Indiegogo. So there are other avenues to take on. And I think it probably, some of those would be less stressful because it's not an all or none model.
Right.
I think the all or none model just like it.
It's rough.
Yeah. It's very rough. The last one, I had many arguments at home during that time because I was just a lunatic. I'll admit it. You know, you
losing your mind, right?
And especially for someone who has OCD like I do, and you're fixated on, oh my God, this is going to tank. This is going to tank. This is going to tank. I have $4,000 and we need to get to $6,000. Is this going to happen? Oh my God. Oh my God. And your brain just takes you to dark places.
Yeah. I was an observer on a recent person who's local, who's also publishing people of color and queer anthologies and different things like that. And it was down to the wire for her stuff. And I was like trying to throw it everywhere on the internet being like, please, she just needs $1,000, you know? So, and I wasn't even a part of it. Yeah. So I can only imagine how it is to be in that seat.
I'm getting anxious just hearing these stories.
Right? I mean, every day I was like, is it?
But that's a huge part of it too. And I mean, we just met, but I appreciate you telling that piece and your involvement in that because those projects, it really takes Team Comics to come together and share them.
It does. It's word of mouth, right?
Yeah. And
it's
anthologies exposure. Anthologies are actually a little easier because you have however many contributors to the book.
So many more voices to spread out.
Times their social networks.
Exactly.
Right.
And when it's just you, like it's much smaller. So for everyone that shared the project, I really appreciate you. Thank you so much. It does make a difference.
It does.
And so thank you for also advocating for the book that you're talking about.
Well, there's a lot of stuff that we carry, including your stuff, and it's all really important things. A lot of it's LGBT, a lot of it's more inclusion and diversity, and we need more of those voices. Yeah.
Yep. And that's a change from the first time that I had been in comics to now,
right?
Even participants in conventions are so much more diverse.
Oh, it was so gay last year at Emerald City. It was totally my jam.
Yeah,
it was great.
I was a little nervous because I did Ace Comic Con this year here in Seattle, and like we literally didn't know what to expect. I tabled with Tatiana Gill, and there was a gentleman who walked by the first night who had a "Got Ammo?" T-shirt on. And we just sort of grabbed onto each other's arms. We're like, we are in the wrong place. What the hell have we done?
Oh, no.
And then, like, we had the cutest trans couple come up to us, and they were so excited, and they just gushed over things. And like, we're so glad you're here. And we had the whole, come back if you need help going to the bathroom. Like, we'll spot you and all this stuff. So then it just became a super queer show on day two. So it was amazing. And it's that kind of stuff. You just would not have expected that at like the Avengers show, but
yeah.
It truly was.
Yeah, right. That's what it was. Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, the Captain America Bucky love is strong.
I know. Yes. He is America's ass.
That's right. He is America's ass.
Yes.
Do you mind if I ask a question?
Go for it.
Go for it.
This comes across my lap really a good timing because I watched Dragula, and through that I found somebody who does a podcast called Dead to Filth, which is mm-hmm. all about horror yep. movies and filmmakers and queer, either in people who are directors or creators. And so it's really interesting to see the horror and the LGBT stuff come together. And I'm curious on what your take is on what prompted this genre and time period and having mm-hmm. it be LGBT.
I appreciate you asking this question because I would add to the previous question about Kickstarter. One of the epiphanies I had during week two of the dead period in the Kickstarter was that there were all of these queer horror and just regular horror podcasts that I had not tapped into.
Mm.
So I immediately started, I was like, I'm going to get every horror director. I want women horror directors, queer horror directors, horror podcasts, queer horror podcasts. And I truly believe that that made a difference
wow.
in those weeks that it was really like questioning my life goals. So yes, you're absolutely right. There is a whole new exploration of the intersection of queerness and horror.
Mm-hmm.
Shudder, the channel Shudder, yeah. is doing a queer horror documentary that's coming out pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
They've been posting photos of like people looking at the set. They don't show you what the set looks like, but clearly people are impressed by it. So I would recommend everyone check that out when they get a chance. So for me, to get back to your question, mm-hmm. I'm a lifelong horror fan. Like I've just loved horror movies since I was... gosh, probably 8 or 9. So that's always been there. Is it okay if I get political? Is that
absolutely.
I mean, not overtly political.
You're good. Go for
but
it.
But I'll say
depends on what side of the spectrum you're on. But well, I can probably guess.
Yeah. I will say 2016, the election really threw me for a loop. It threw me for a loop because I had so many family members who were talking as if they had been possessed. Just like saying things that you would have never thought would have come out of their mouths or would have been acceptable to even believe. Like it just changed mm-hmm. the way that I viewed a lot of people that I was deeply connected to. It was difficult because I was advising the college's LGBTQ Resource Center at the time, and I had people who were too afraid to come to campus the mm-hmm. next day.
Mm-hmm.
I had people who were just in tears in the center. I had to call the counseling center and get someone to come over. So there were ancillary waves around me of people that were terrified of what was going to happen. And as a gay person, I'm pretty terrified too. Like you can just look at the news and you see that we're targets just like people of color are, just like immigrants are. And so that election really, I just had to start rage writing.
Mm.
And I had always, like some strange disturbances, it started as a game that my friend that I was talking about earlier, the one who I would send the comics to, she was running on this story platform. It's called Storium, and it's basically a text adventure. You have cards and you kind of play based on the moves that she sets up. And so the story was not called Some Strange Disturbances. It was called The Lunchroom Under the Arch. And so we always talked about, we were super interested in the contest and Prescott, and we talked about always trying to do something together. And eventually, like, the election came, and I was like, look, do you mind if I get started on this on my own? Because I really need an outlet right now.
Yeah.
So I didn't even know if I was really ever going to do anything with it. But just as I kept writing it and pieces kept falling into place, like Delilah coming in and the contest coming in and the Oscar Wilde trial, I realized in talking with the students that they had no idea of the history that we have lived mm-hmm. for thousands
yeah.
of years.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really important as part of this story to, you know, have queer people facing difficulty, but like they're not destroyed or completely beaten down. So just the reminder that this stuff happens all the time and we do get through it, and it sucks while we're trying to get through it, but that is life. And so to bring in the horror element just made sense to me as I was writing it, because I was so scared and everybody around me was so scared. And I think fear comes from different places. It can come from the unknown. It can come from the things that we're trying to hide that we don't want coming out, or it can come from monsters and ghosts and all kinds of other spookies. And so, yeah.
It lines up pretty easily then in that way, right?
It does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry for the long answer.
No, I love it. Thank you.
It was really, really wonderful.
2016 was a game changer. Yeah. That's why we became nonprofit.
So. Yeah.
Yeah.
We had an after-hours book club where there was drinking.
And, you know, Ben and I are part of the Seattle Fringe Theater community, and how a lot of people responding to all of this was, well, there's going to be some good theater coming out of this.
Yeah.
Which has been true, but you know, it didn't even occur to me to say, there's going to be a lot of good comics coming out of this. So I really love hearing that story, that how that you, the genesis of that. That's, what did you say, Right Through Your Hate?
Yeah, Right Through My Rage.
Through My Rage. Mm-hmm. Can I steal that?
Yes, please.
All right, while Cole thinks about what he's going to put that on.
Oh, no, I'm raging up right now, man.
Do we have any final questions for Craig?
Real quick, you were at Genghis Khan Cleveland this past week, which is a great convention name, by the way. That's a small press and independent comic expo, and that treated you well. We were talking beforehand.
Yes, it's a fantastic show. My brother lives in Cleveland, so one of my goals for this year, as I was getting, I called it earlier, the Return of Headless Shakespeare Press World Tour 2019.
Nice.
And you guys are my final stop on that tour for the year. But I intentionally tried to pick places where I knew I had family or friends, because as part of that rage writing, just checking in with people and seeing how they're doing is really important.
Yeah.
In addition to like meeting up at comic shows and just seeing what like the young kids are doing. And I say young kids, and I don't mean that pedantically or to like talk down to anybody, because it's amazing to see the diversity of product that's coming out right now.
The new voices coming out.
Absolutely. And it gives me hope to see that. And just like, again, that wouldn't have happened 20 years ago. And the power of doing your own books, like you don't have corporate control telling you what your story should be or can be. Genghis Khan was amazing. If people can go, do it. If you can get a table and do it, do it.
Cool.
Wonderful. Cool. Craig, it's been really great having you. If people want to find more of your stuff, where should they go?
They can come to the Comic Extension, or they can go online to hspcomics.com. So comix.com.
Great.
And we'll also figure out a signing event soon.
That'd be fantastic.
So,
I'd love to do it.
We'll post that up on the social medias when it happens.
Yeah. Like the Comics Dungeon's Facebook page for more info on that. Perfect Bound Podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, as well as Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsengine.com. Subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts or however you get your shows at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you once again, Craig, for being with us.
Thank you.
And we will see you next week.